This is Endocrine Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Hello and welcome again to the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast for our 31st episode. Today, we will look at a recent article from the JCENM that explores the changes in glucose control in type 1 diabetes that occur throughout the menstrual cycle. This is a question that gets posed to me frequently as a clinician, so I found it extremely helpful to review this study as only a few reports on this topic exist in the medical literature. As usual for us, these authors use an observational design, but theirs is a particularly strong one, so we're going to explore that in detail together. I host the Endocrine Feedback Loop, but spend most of my time as a general endocrinologist at Vanderbilt University, where I am the medical director for our endocrinology clinics and an associate director for our fellowship program. Returning today as our regular contributor and resident expert in diabetes technology is Steve Whitland. He works at the University of Rochester, where he is also a general endocrinologist and the clinical director, but has a special clinical and research focus on diabetes, diabetes technology, and innovations in diabetes treatment. Joining us in our virtual recording studio as our guest expert today is Mary Kortkowski from the University of Pittsburgh. Her clinical focus is on inpatient and outpatient diabetes, and she was the medical director at the UPMC Center for Diabetes and Endocrinology for many years. She is widely known for her research in diabetes, attested to by her numerous publications and committee work, including guideline committees. As should be obvious, I have just the right group of diabetologists joining me to discuss this article. Also, as usual, everything we say will be our opinions only and not those of our respective institutions or of the Endocrine Society. For this month of the podcast, we tackle ambulatory glucose profile according to different phases of the menstrual cycle in women living with type 1 diabetes. The Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism published this article in October 2022. So Pio Tetulashvili from the Université Paris served as the first author with colleagues from Avicenna Hospital and Lariboisière Hospital. At this point, I'll turn things over to Steve. He will walk us through the points that the authors make in their introduction, as well as getting Mary's help in understanding some of the key background concepts here. Steve?
Thanks, Chase and Mary, and good morning. So the key point here is that there are some women, at least to one's clinical impression, with type 1 diabetes who note changes in their glucose control during different phases of the menstrual cycle. There are several previous studies based on capillary blood glucose measurements, but only a few of these studies, which are small, have actually looked at continuous glucose monitoring. And these studies, to give you an idea, are just between 4 and 12 subjects. These studies only looked at either the follicular or luteal phases, and some of them have reported trends for higher glucose in the luteal phase, but not all. I just wanted to turn it over to Mary for a moment and ask about her clinical experience with menstrual adjustments in glucose and possible mechanisms for changes in glucose control through the menstrual cycle and why it's important.
First of all, thank you for inviting me to be part of this. I am really glad that you chose this topic to address because menstrual cyclicity and reproductive function is an important component of the health of women with diabetes. And it's certainly something that affects women to a greater extent than it does men. There are many women, but not all women, who experience changes in their glucose controls over the course of their menstrual cycle. Some women experience a lot of difficulty with their glycemic control, usually during their two-week period preceding menses. Other women notice no change, and some women notice even more hypoglycemia during this time. And it is often a topic that's not addressed by physicians at the time of history taking with women. It's an often overlooked portion of the medical history, but a very important part.
So this study does an evaluation of glucose excursions in patients with type 1 diabetes during all 5 phases of the menstrual cycle. And in a second, I'll ask Mary to tell us what those 5 cycles are and what's happening hormonally. But concluding, their hypothesis is that the time in range would decrease in the luteal phase. So, Mary?
It's really interesting that they broke it down into the five phases. There is a study, I think it was published in 1992, that they referenced by Whittam et al. That was a study that I actually used a lot to guide my management of women, where they only studied women at two phases of the cycle. But they did a very intensive study where they did glucose clamps, where they looked at how much glucose had to be infused in order to maintain a desired glucose level at the time. And they actually treated women to a high glucose level of about 180, 190. They only studied 16 women, but they found that about half of the women that were studied actually had a decline in the amount of glucose required to achieve their desired glucose level during the luteal phase of their menstrual cycle, which was a sign of more insulin resistance, while the other half noted really no difference. So now just to explain the follicular phase and the luteal phases. So this group in the paper that we're talking about, they used the first day of the menstrual cycle is day one. And so then anything after day one of the onset of menstruation would be considered the follicular phase. So it's when a new follicle, which is lying quiescent within the ovary, starts to develop under hormonal regulation of usually estrogen, and then progesterone comes in later. So the early follicular phase that they define in this study is day one through three of the menstrual cycle. So some women may be even menstruating during that time. The mid follicular phase they define as day six through eight, which is usually menses are over and the estrogen levels are gradually increasing. Progesterone levels tend to stay low. And then they define this periovulatory time, when the time when ovulation occurs, as day minus 16 to minus 14. So now they're sort of counting towards the onset of menstruation. Immediately preceding ovulation, there is usually an increase in both follicle stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone, which are the pituitary hormones that actually prompt ovulation. There's just a peak. And then they fall, your ovulation occurs. And then during the second phase of the cycle, you have a mature follicle now. This is when pregnancy can occur. Progesterone levels start to rise. Progesterone levels gradually rise during the luteal phase of the menstrual cycle, reaching a peak during the late luteal phase, and then plummeting with the onset of menstruation. It's that plummet in progesterone, if pregnancy has not occurred, that causes menstruation to occur. So it's complicated. It's very complicated. There are nice figures that show this. And the study that I quoted earlier by Whittam, they studied two different phases. They studied the middle of the follicular phase and the middle of the luteal phase. Here, these authors have broken it down even more discreetly into early, late follicular, periovulatory period, and then two periods during the luteal phase. So it's a very elegant study in that regard, in which they were able to gather data.
All right. Thank you, Steve and Mary, for that nice overview and particularly a reminder of the physiology that's going on throughout the menstrual cycle. I think that's always helpful to be reminded of that. We're going to come back to that. So I think it's going to be helpful to do a few passes. So when we actually look at the definitions that the authors use in their methodology, well, I'll go through those definitions again. So first of all, what we're going to do is think about study design overall. And with this one, I think it's going to be most helpful to think about this at least similar to a retrospective cohort study. And I'll explain later why it's maybe not exactly like that, though I think it's actually an improvement on a typical retrospective cohort study. So as a reminder of what those types of investigations are, so a cohort study is when you have a group of individuals, that's your cohort, and they share something in common. So in this situation, it'll be women with type 1 diabetes. And then you split them into two or sometimes multiple groups based on an exposure. And then you follow them over time to see if an exposed or an unexposed group develops an outcome of interest more or less frequently. And what makes it a retrospective is that you start your study after all of the data has been collected. That's as opposed to a prospective study to where you're defining upfront exactly what information you will be collecting, in which case you're following those people in real time. There's no real time following, so you're stuck with whatever data you have for the most part, that you sometimes have an opportunity to go back and collect additional data. And I think that this fits best with that, though the authors don't use this exact description. So let's actually do that. Let's look at this study. We've heard just a little bit already about how this is set up. But I mentioned this is an observational study. It does appear to be retrospective. The authors don't necessarily state that, but it does appear that that's at least how most of the data was obtained. So it'll be a little bit different from a retrospective cohort study because the exposed groups are actually all the same people, and it's just that it's at different time. And so we'll look at exactly how the authors define that and use that when we get to the exposure. So more on that in just a second. I mentioned the two hospitals in the introduction. So it's two hospitals in France in particular that these women come from as patients. And the inclusion criteria, first of all, so this had to be adult woman with type 1 diabetes. Second, it had to be premenopausal with menstrual cycles of normal length. And then finally, these individuals had to be using a CGM. And in particular, it was a Libre and it had to be shared with the clinic so that they had that data available. And these are also had to be individuals who were following up regularly with the clinic. So I wanted to stop here and get Steve and Mary's input. We'll start with Steve as our CGM expert. So Steve, as you think about this, particularly that they were using a Libre, and it seems that with any of these studies of technology, by the time a study is published, we already have newer versions of whatever it is out. So when you think about this, any limitations that you would draw from this based on the particular type of technology that's used here, particularly when compared with what we're using these days?
Just that this was the original Libre and had a mean absolute relative difference of about 10%. And that just means that in order to not skew, for example, for an MARD or mean absolute relative difference, theoretically, out of 100 people, you could have 50 who are below a certain target, 50 who are above, and they would neutralize each other unless you turned all the numbers into absolute values. So the mean absolute relative difference, about 10%. It depends on how tight your numbers are, because a small change in time and range could reflect the error of the Libre. Also, the original Libre was not terrific in the very low range. So they do look at a hypoglycemic index and time below range in the study. And again, if the numbers are widely separate when you're comparing groups, that's not a problem. If the numbers are minimally different, then that would affect the numbers that you're getting.
Using the Libre has really been revolutionary in certainly understanding what happens with people. Before, we just had 4 times a day blood glucose monitoring. And now we just have so much more information about what's going on. So I really commend the authors for using this technology to investigate this area that's really not well studied at all and really adds to literature. Interestingly enough, I think their results are consistent with what's been found in the few other studies that have existed, but they actually provide more data emphasizing those points. They actually tried to get at least 3 cycles from each woman, and they got that from most women. From some women, they only got 2 cycles, and there were a couple with only 1 cycle, but they looked at the data with and without those women. It was fairly consistent. So the weaknesses that exist with any continuous glucose monitoring system were there throughout the whole period. And there's so much data that we can look at trends. And I think these differences in absolute glucose and what the Libre is telling us sort of fall away then, especially with such a low MARD.
Good. Thanks. So, and we'll come back to some of those ideas here in just a second. So those are the inclusion criteria. So now we'll look at the exclusion criteria. There were a few. So these individuals could not have had any significant changes recently. And the authors defined that as change in lifestyle, so it was diet or activity, or changes in their treatment regimen, and that's within the past 3 months. They couldn't have uncontrolled diabetes, and the authors used a cutoff of a 10% of an A1C for that. Because they were studying menstrual cycles, they excluded individuals who were pregnant or were lactating. And these women could not have any form of hormonal contraception being used. And they also excluded individuals with PCOS or gastroparesis. The data that was collected, we mentioned this already, but it appears to have been retrospective, mostly from medical records. And as always with medical records, there's always some limitations because you are left with however accurate that is. When it's retrospective, often the people who are putting the information into the medical medical records didn't know that they were going to be a part of a study, and so maybe weren't as specific and accurate as they would have been otherwise. So always a limitation there that's intrinsic to these sort of studies. And now we're going to think about the exposures. And I think this is really a strength of this study. And we're going to go back through some of those definitions and get Mary's input here in a second on that. And the reason I think that this is so helpful is because of how they define their groups based on exposure. So again, with a typical cohort, you have a group of people, maybe around half are in one group, they weren't exposed, and in another group, maybe around half or the opposite there. But in this, because it's looking at the menstrual cycle, everybody is in all of the groups. It's just you are in different exposure groups at different times. And actually, when I read this and looked at this description, it sounded very much like a crossover RCT. And in those, in clinical trials, that are crossover, then you have somebody who participates in a placebo arm and then at some point will cross over and actually be taking the active medication that's under investigation. So again, this is observational study, but because of the nature of the menstrual cycle, people naturally go from one group to another. And so I think it's particularly strong here is that there's relatively little concern for confounders, because whatever a confounder one subject might have, they're going to be in every group. So for a large part, those are going to cancel each other out. So we're going to keep thinking about that. Mary mentioned this, but the cycle data was self-reported, and they tried to collect up to three cycles for all of these women and the five phases. I'm going to go through them again. Mary gave us an overview already, but I think multiple passes of this is helpful to keep mm-hmm. them in our mind. So first of all, there was the early follicular phase. That was days 1 through 3. The mid follicular, that was 6 through 8. And then the periovulatory, and that's where they switched to that counting down. So that was negative 16 to negative 14. Then mid luteal, that's negative 9 to negative 7. And then finally late luteal, that was negative 3 to negative 1. And as one final comment, the authors wanted to make sure that they did have enough data. We've already talked a little bit about some intrinsic limitations with those early versions of the CGM and how much variability there could be. But the authors wanted to be careful and say that if they actually didn't capture the data at all, meaning if they had phases that had less than 70% of the time captured, then that data was excluded. So Mary, you gave us a few thoughts already. Any additional thoughts on these definitions around the phases here or anything else that would give you pause as we think about defining groups based on exposure?
A couple of thoughts. I think they described regular menses as 28 to 35 days. There's variability right there. And, you know, they're using the same days. And they do talk about that in the limitations, that they can't really be sure that these are really matching specifically. And they're not doing any hormonal measures to confirm that this is indeed the early or late luteal phase over time. They could move to that study. That'll be a more complicated and more expensive study. The other area where I really questioned is they said they excluded women with polycystic ovary syndrome. I couldn't tell what exclusion criteria they used. Some women with PCOS, which is a very common disorder of women of reproductive age, can have reasonably regular menstrual cycles and may have more acne or hirsutism or infertility, and we don't have that information. We also don't have information about pregnancies in these women or reports of infertility. These are minor points, but they are some things that could have affected the results.
Yeah, and we'll think about that more. The authors make some comments on that in their strengths and limitations. So at the very end, we'll consider that a little bit further. Okay, moving on with the methodology here. So outcomes. So we've just looked at exposures, and we're going to compare groups based on exposure to see if the outcomes are different. So now we're going to look at what those outcomes are. So the authors define their primary outcome as time and range. They look at a host of secondary outcomes. They looked at time below range, time above range, several others, and Steve's going to walk us through those when we get to the results. But I did want to stop here as we're thinking about this, and we'll start with Steve and get his input. Do you think that time and range is the best? That's obviously the main thing that we've moved to clinically. And the authors are going to talk about some of the impacts they're looking, and though they maybe don't state it this way, it certainly looks that based on the physiology that they're describing, that they're actually looking for hyperglycemia more than anything else. So Steve, do you think time and range was the best here, or maybe would have been time above range been a better thing to focus? Or what are your thoughts on selection of a primary outcome?
I think there's a lot of focus on picking one of the ambulatory glucose profile as the preferable variable to look at. I think we're all smart enough to look at 3 or 4. To answer your question, I don't know that it would have been wrong to have two primary outcomes, one time above range and one time in range. but I don't know that there was a better single outcome than time in range.
Good. That makes sense. I guess that's certainly the one that we've moved to clinically using over the past few years primarily. Finally, as far as additional outcome data, questionnaires were obtained, and they were used in a few different ways here. And they were trying to identify the subjects, the women's impressions of changes in glucose, diet, physical activity, and insulin doses during the cycle. So a couple of comments I would make here. One is that anytime you're doing questionnaires, asking people to think back and remember, and particularly when they know what group they were in. So since the groups are defined based on where they were in the menstrual cycles, they were specifically being asked that. So there's always a risk for recall bias here. I don't think that was avoidable, but something that we have to be aware of, that people might be thinking about things and reporting things differently simply because they know whether they were exposed or in this study, in which phase of the menstrual cycle they were. Finally, though, I'll mention another way that really the reason the authors use this, often this type of information is obtained to try to identify confounders and adjust for those. That was relatively limited concern here because of this really strong observational design. And I think primarily what the authors were trying to do was identify mediators. So to make a distinction there, a confounder is something that is associated with what you have labeled as the exposure. And it's that association that can make you think that what you've labeled your exposure is driving the outcome when it's really this other variable, this confounder. A mediator is different. A mediator is actually in that causal pathway. So you have something that you're studying. And so here we would associate hormonal changes in the menstrual cycle. But then those may be actually leading to something else, a mediator, and it's that mediator that is then driving the outcomes of interest. So that's why the authors did this, to try to understand what mediators might be. We're going to look at those in the results and talk about them in the conclusion, but I did like how that was done here. So finally, well, just a brief comment on the statistics. As usual, we don't spend a lot of time delving into that, but in Steve, and as he was analyzing this, had some questions, particularly about how they think about multiple variables here. So Steve, any comments that you'd like to make on the statistical methodology before we wrap up?
Yeah, so it turns out that it doesn't make a difference because the major outcomes don't fall under this rubric, but they select a p-value as significant of less than 0.05. And there's a lot in the scientific literature about A, the use of p-values, and B, the p less than 0.05, which means that there's less than a 1 in 20 chance that this is by chance alone. In their first table, they have 33 variables. I counted them up. So saying that there's less than a 1 in 20 chance that it's by chance alone really has to be corrected for the number of variables that you have. So I don't know that 0.05 was appropriate, but it turns out that the major variables that turned out to be important are such slam dunks that it doesn't matter.
Good. That's helpful and sets us up nicely for the results section. So I'm going to turn it over to Steve to walk us through that section and the data that the authors identify there. Steve?
So they screened 107 individuals and they excluded 63, amongst which 20 had inadequate data. There were 24 subjects who had 62 cycles. 71% of them, or 17 subjects, had three consecutive cycles. 17%, or four of the subjects, had two consecutive cycles, and 14%, i.e. three of them, had one cycle. And they had an excellent correlation coefficient of 0.94. It doesn't get much better than that. The main finding was that there was a linear decline in the time in range, which was the primary outcome, from the early follicular phase to the late luteal phase. P equals 0.02. So there my comment does come into play. There is a better correlation during the daytime. The time above range, the high glucose blood index, and the mean glucose were all higher in the late luteal phase. They then divide the subjects into two groups, those with and those without a decline as described. This has been done in other studies, but obviously they didn't have five groups the way this study does. The ones who had no decline had a lower hemoglobin A1C. They had a shorter duration of diabetes. So we're talking the A1C was about 1 percentage point lower, and they had a duration of diabetes that was half that of the group that did show the variability. They had fewer insulin adjustments, to say none. And I'm going to ask Mary at this point, any hypotheses as to why these two groups showed the variability versus non-variability.
An interesting point of this paper is this duration of diabetes. So I don't know it's so much the duration of the diabetes. I think it's the age of diagnosis of their diabetes. There is a remote literature that shows that girls who are diagnosed with type 1 diabetes before the onset of menstruation, defined as menarche, have more menstrual irregularities and difficulties controlling their blood sugars later in life. They're older at the time of puberty. They have earlier menopause if we take it further out, and they report more menstrual irregularities than girls who are diagnosed after they go through puberty. So I thought that was an important point. So even though these two groups are matched for age, there's no significant difference. There is, just by definition, just doing the math shows that they were diagnosed at a much younger age group, and that makes a difference. The difference in A1C, I thought, was kind of interest. If glucose levels have any impact on menstrual cyclicity, or if menstrual cyclicity affects glucose levels, I think that was another interesting point, because that is one of the places where women have a harder time. The fact that they have more difficulty controlling their blood sugars half the time, if they spend half their time in the luteal phase and the time in range is lower, that is going to contribute to a higher A1C. And I know there is talk about moving away from HbA1c and towards time in range is the better measure of glycemic control. So those were two things that really struck me with looking at the differences here.
Thank you. That's very helpful. So we're going to come back to that as we think about implications, what we should be taking away from this study. So more to come on that in just a second. So now what we're going to do is look at the author's discussion and evaluate some of the things that they review. So first of all, as far as the main conclusion, the authors state that the time in range linearly decreased from the beginning to the end of the menstrual cycle in about 70% of subjects. The authors then go on in their report to do a literature review. We've touched on some of these already. There's not a lot of information that's out there. And we said this as well before, that this is really very similar, though there's more information, and particularly with the CGM, we get far more details. It is very similar to the other studies that are out there in terms of those findings. The authors then go on to go through what you could think of as either the physiology or the pathophysiology, however you wanted to define that, as to, well, what might be driving this? What's going on here? And the thought is that this is probably, these changes that we see are related to changes in insulin sensitivity. They go through a variety of other studies that support that and indicate that increasing progesterone throughout the cycle, Mary walked us through that already, there's fairly good evidence that increasing progesterone levels will increase insulin resistance. They also then look at some of the data around estrogen and say, well, it's really not nearly as strong. It suggests that increasing estrogen levels throughout the cycle will increase insulin resistance. So that's not as consistent as a finding as it is with progesterone. The authors then look at, well, maybe it's nutrient intake. And to go back to what we were discussing before, they're trying to understand if that might be a mediator. So if maybe progesterone and estrogen levels are changing throughout the cycle, that is then driving a change in nutrient intake. And then the nutrient intake is what's actually causing this difference in time and range in the majority of women throughout the cycle. So they say, well, there's a potential explanation, but their data didn't show that. That's the reason they did those questionnaires. And when they look at that, did not find a clear association between at least retrospectively reported nutrient intake. So again, limitations there, but no obvious link there. So we mentioned this before as well. So the authors go through their strengths and limitations. So we're going to come back to those and see what the authors state. And we'll think about that and any more that we might add. First of all, they point out that this is a large study, certainly compared to what's out there in the medical literature already. This is a very large study, and that it used CGM. So both of those are very strong points that the authors make. They also say that this is a highly selective subject selection. And the authors describe this as a strength, meaning they're able to go through and really try to hone in as much as possible. And I would comment, Mary's made this suggestion already, is that I think with this, when you really select down, yes, you can maybe narrow down a little bit more, but it also significantly limits the generalizability. So yes, we understand in this group of individuals who didn't have PCOS, who had pretty normal menstrual cycles, what's going on. But then it does raise the question, well, is this going to be applicable to women with PCOS or gastroparesis or any of the other things that are excluded. And I'll just say as an aside, it's almost always a study's strength is often its weakness. So however hard you push on one side, then you start sacrificing other things. And the authors decided to go for selectivity here, but necessarily sacrifice some generalizability when they did that. The authors do point out that this is a lot of self-reported data, particularly with those questionnaires. So that's always going to be a limitation there. And I'll ask Steve and Mary, any other limitations that you would like to point out or strengths as well that you would add to what the authors themselves have listed?
Well, first of all, I think I've said, I think this is a very strong study. I mean, you've already pointed out some of the limitations. One of the limitations that I might add is that when we're looking at the clinical variables and the glycemic variables overall, they do break it down into two cohorts. They take the women who had decrease in time in range during the luteal phase and compare those to the women who didn't notice that change. But yet when they're reporting the day versus night data, it's grouped together. So there are times where they're separated and other times where we're looking at the group as a whole. I mean, they could report this in another study or another report down the road. The other thing is, so you already pointed out the hormonal contributors to these changes in glycemic measures over the course of a menstrual cycle, but it's really hard to measure the behavioral side of this. You know, have heard of the term premenstrual syndrome. Some of us have lived through the premenstrual syndrome. It's a time where it's not always severe, but a lot of women, even without diabetes, feel like a little difficulty feeling under control of their lives and their feelings during this time. And it can be very subtle. There can be changes in sleep. There can be changes in carbohydrate craving. There can just be general feelings of just not feeling great during that time. In women with type 1 diabetes, they have an additional issue. If they're really working to be under control, and then they hit this phase of the menstrual cycle where they can't really predict what's going to be happening, that just adds to their stress. And stress is a component to higher blood sugar levels as well. So I don't really mean that as a criticism for the study. It's just things that are very difficult to measure. The findings that they come up with are real, that there's a certain number of women who have difficulty with control, and there's other women who seem to sail through that. If we look at the women who didn't have decrease in time in range and they had lower blood glucose levels, where they had difficulty was in the follicular phase of the menstrual cycle, where they had more hypoglycemia. Hypoglycemia itself is stressful and can contribute to higher levels of stress and a feeling of not being under control. So we're talking about glucose values here, but they impact how women feel about their day-to-day lives when they have jobs, they have families, and they're just trying to keep it all under control.
Yeah, Mary, I think that's great. I think that really well illustrates this mediator's idea. So we mm-hmm. see this association with the menstrual cycle phases, but we don't necessarily know exactly what's then driving the glucose changes. It may be directly the hormones, but again, something else, and you've given us several great examples of what it could be. It could be hormonal changes are causing something else, and then it's that something else, stress, you gave as a potential example, that's then affecting the glucose. So those are wonderful points to make there. Steve, anything else that you would add to the strengths and limitations list?
That it's retrospective, it does rely a lot on chart data. And one of the questions I had when I looked at this, and maybe things are different in Pittsburgh than they are in Rochester, but the label of type 1 diabetes is often sloppy. And they're relying basically on the chart label of type 1 diabetes, which may be correct again, but I don't know that. I don't know. I certainly don't know how it is in France. So that's one thing. And the big question, which Mary has alluded to, is the chicken and the egg. Is the poor control affecting the menstrual cycle? Is the menstrual cycle affecting the worse control? Or are they feeding back against one another? Is the fact that someone is having poor control, are they more stressed during a period that's inherently stressful, i.e. the luteal phase? Or is it the other way around? And the other thing relates to a point Mary made earlier. These women who had more variability had the diabetes longer. And we tend to lump people into diagnoses. But people with type 1 diabetes, it has been demonstrated in several studies, have variable amounts of residual insulin secretion. Mm-hmm. And having diabetes for 20 years versus 10 years may mean they have less beta cell function at the same age, and that may be affecting control during fluctuations of the menstrual cycle. So I think all these have to be taken into account, and I think it's an important study. I think it's a really well-done study. Again, they mentioned the numbers, and I think we need a larger study, and I'll allude to why when I discuss alternatives to treatment here.
Good, thank you. And so we'll wrap up here with what the authors state in their conclusion. So first of all, they give a summary again. So time and range deteriorates as the menstrual cycle progresses. And then the authors provide us with a couple of implications. So first of all, they suggest that providers should take these changes into consideration. And Mary gave us some thoughts on that already, is that we probably don't do a particularly good job of that. So I think that that's certainly a warranted implication there. And they provide a final interesting one, is looking forward, saying that closed-loop systems will adapt basal rates to address these fluctuations. So where I want us to finish things here is thinking about, well, should this change our practice in other ways, or what other things should we be taking away from this? Mary and Steve have both commented already about their views of the quality of this report, that it's a really good one. And I would add my own to that, is that this is really impressive, much larger studies that have been done before, and I think really provides a lot of information in an area to where we've had some data, but not nearly as much as we need to guide a very common clinical scenario. So I think we've all been really impressed with the quality of this report. Where I'd like us to wrap up is thinking about the author's proposed implications here. And Steve, we'll start with you. And I'm interested in particular, again, as our technology expert here, that final implication that the authors mentioned, that closed loop systems are going to really help a lot here. What thoughts do you have on that, or anything else related to those implications or conclusions?
A, thank you for my appointed expertise, and B, we ought to qualify it as diabetes technology expert, because my children would tell you that I'm certainly not a technology expert. But it seems to me, whenever I have a clinical question, if I look hard enough, I find an article. And in fact, there was an article that was published around the same time as this study. The first author is Carol Levy, and they actually looked at the tandem closed loop system, the so-called control IQ, in a group of women. And again, it was a little smaller than this group. And they found no changes in the menstrual cycle in the patients on the control IQ, which could mean one of several things. A, they just happened to grab the right group of people and they would have fallen into our category of non-variable people. B, that the closed loop certainly can have an impact on managing this. Or C, the selection of people who would willing to be on a closed loop may be people who have better control to begin with. And we're back to the chicken and egg. Is the menstrual cycle affecting the control affecting the menstrual variabilities, or a combination thereof? But certainly, I would try a hybrid closed loop pump.
Good. Thank you, Steve. And Mary, we're going to end things with you here. So give us your thoughts on these conclusions, on the implications. Are there other ones that you would suggest that we draw from this? And then in addition to that, what other unanswered questions do you have? So this is a great addition to the medical literature. We've said that already. But do you have other questions that you think further studies are going to need to try to answer?
Earlier, we said that this is an important but often overlooked part of the medical history. The question is, okay, so if you do take this medical history and you do find this variability among women, what do you do about it? Not all women, not all men for that matter, are on closed loop systems. This will probably change over time, but there are still people who are on multiple daily injections or pump therapy that is not tied into a closed loop system. So what do you do with those women? I can talk about what I have done, because there's not a lot of literature about this, is actually have women track their cycles so that they can sort of preemptively either increase insulin to carbohydrate ratios or prandial insulin doses, and in some cases, even their basal insulin doses or basal rates. And some women do that. They actually have that in pumps, which allow you to have more than one setting. They can have their setting for the luteal phase. Another thing that I have done, and I know that this is just opinion, so no one has to endorse this practice, but what I have done with several women who really had extreme variability during their menstrual cycles, is put them on continuous monophasic oral contraceptives. And then they can choose how often they want to menstruate. But if they're on a balanced dose of an estrogen and progesterone containing oral contraceptive, that eliminates that menstrual cyclicity so that they are more stable and more in control. Not all women want to do that, but I've had several patients who have done this and it's worked very well for them. And it would be nice to have a study of that for these kind of women. And I think the closed loop systems do offer hope for a lot of women, for a lot of patients in their day-to-day lives where they're not having to pay attention to their glucose control all the time. It's not just about menstruation. You're talking about mediators and indicators earlier, but there are other studies that have looked at this issue of menstrual irregularities. We published a study ourselves in 2015 looking at women who reported difficulty with menstrual cycles, but this has been reported in others. The family autoimmune study that was published many years ago showed this, but women who report irregular menses also are found to have a higher incidence of diabetes-related complications. And the FAD study, the family autoimmune disease study, they actually found that these women with irregular menses were more likely to have coronary artery calcification. So this has implications for cardiovascular risk down the road as well. More associations than direct, but it's more than just irregular periods. It's really maybe directing us to more cardiovascular risk reduction in these particular women.
And with that, I would like to thank Steve Whitland and Mary Kortkowski for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I learned a lot and know that you all did as well. Please join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of the Endocrine Society with production oversight by Brandy Brown and Andrew Harmon.